we in the Alden history community call certain outdated science fiction to be honorary Alden history, but...
Hello, 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 and welcome to Living a Life Through Books, the podcast about everything bookish. I'm your host, Dr. Shanaz Ahmed, and today I am hoping to be schooled. I'm not a huge sci-fi alternate history fan, so when Alex offered to be on my podcast, I jumped on it. Why not? Those are acceptable genres, aren't they? So today we have a guest. Alexander Wallace is a nerd on the internet, best known for running Alternate History Online, the largest alternate history group on Facebook. He also helps run the Alternate Timelines Forum and posts regularly on alternate history sites under the name Spanish Spy. When not being an alternate historian, he is interested in various forms of science fiction, particularly late 19th, early 20th century science fiction, with a soft spot for H.G. Wells. He's a member of the Washington Science Fiction Society and has written articles for their journal. I can't wait to see what he says, and let's take it from the beginning. Here's Alex. Alex, welcome to the Living a Life Through Books podcast. I'm really excited to have you here.
Nice being here. Thank you very much for having me on here.
All right. So Alex, I just want to tell our listeners that we're going to talk today about sci-fi, right? Because you're the sci-fi guru or something like that, I'm told.
Really, I'm just some nerd. I've written a couple of things for specialty like blogs. But, like, I'm not a published author except for a couple of articles and, like, not even peer-reviewed stuff. But I have a lot of books and I read a lot, so I have opinions. That may or may not be good enough for you.
No, opinions are great. So let's just start off with sci-fi. What is the sci-fi genre? Like, if I'm reading a book, why would you say Harry Potter's fantasy versus sci-fi, or, you know, what is that switch? Because sci-fi has things that are not in our universe. So for me, they look like fantasy stuff.
When I was being taught the difference of genres in like third grade, I was told that science fiction is something that could possibly happen in the future, and fantasy is something that could never happen. The more recent discussion is that fantasy assumes this romanticist, we can't change things, of the supernatural. Science fiction assumes in enlightenment, we can change things, view of the supernatural.
Sci-fi can happen and it can change the future, but fantasy cannot?
That fantasy is explicitly impossible, and that science fiction is pretending to be possible in the future, which is a contested definition. And there was this whole article in Asimov's magazine a couple of months ago about how this one author thinks the difference is between the very romanticist like conception of the occult and the impossible and fantasy, as opposed to the Enlightenment rationalist view of future technology and science fiction. There are issues with that. And the truth of the matter is that the difference between fantasy and science fiction is something that is not well defined and will lead to a lot of hand-wringing among certain circles, such as in the past couple of years, people are getting mad that the Hugo Awards, the Pulitzer Prize of science fiction, has been going to things some people consider fantasy. And there has been a hand-wringing about this sort of thing.
Okay. So I'm just going to kind of go in a little different realm here. And I'm going to bring in religion. I know, never talk about religion, right? So I'm not going to bring in any specific religion. Let's just take religion in general. most religions assume our higher being and things that can happen, like angels, and I mean, there are beings and all the stuff that, if you're a true religious person, if you say you're Christian or whatever, you believe there's an angel. And now we're going to shift into science fiction and fantasy. And let's say I wrote a book and I put an angel in my book. And now that becomes, technically, that could be science fiction, right? Because based on my religious belief, they exist.
You're not the first person to have had that idea about...
Darn it! But okay, go ahead.
Larry Niven, famous science fiction author, has argued that Dante's Inferno is the first hard science fiction novel by virtue of it involving an immense amount of research and rigor into the implications thereof of everything considered scientific in the society in which Dante lived. So that's not... That's a thing that's been done. There was a short story by Ted Chiang in one of his short story collections about a world in which angels regularly visited Earth and the implications of that. And he went a very Old Testament way with it, in which there are these somewhat Lovecraftian things that act without obvious rhyme or reason to humans. My understanding was that story was a play on the Book of Job. And it's about are the implications of an omnipresent God that acts like the Book of Job.
So basically, these arguments have been floating around, and technically, the lines between sci-fi and fantasy, and I mean potentially religion, is a little fuzzy. Would you say that?
Yes, definitely. There's, of course, another question that has seen an endless amount of hand-wringing is hard science fiction versus soft science fiction, and what is what and what counts as what. And
why don't you tell me what hard science fiction and soft science fiction is, considering I don't know much about science fiction.
Hard science fiction is the sort of thing that at least pretends to be scientifically accurate, to have a certain degree of scientific rigor behind it. Soft science fiction is the more pulpy stuff. It's the Star Wars. It's the Guardians of the Galaxy sort of science fiction. That more pulpy adventure sort of thing that still defines the genre to many outsiders, even as the pulps lost their dominance in the 50s and 60s. I mean, even then, I would argue the pulps aren't as bad as some people say they are. And I think that the hard science fiction chauvinists are doing the history of the genre a disservice by discounting the influence of the pulps on the genre, because it's been something that's been with us since almost the beginning of the genre. It's like the phase immediately after, like, Vaughan and Wells and those people.
You brought up Guardians of the Galaxy. I thought that was fantasy. Like, I had no, like, to me, okay, I haven't, obviously, I mean, I saw the movie. Isn't there a badger in it that talks?
The Rocket Raccoon, yeah.
Yeah, a raccoon, same thing, an animal. I mean, come on. Science fiction? No, absolutely not. Sorry.
The explanation they give in the movie is that Rocket Raccoon is a genetically altered raccoon-like species that was given sentience, and the whole notion of uplifting animals is an old thing in science fiction. So it is a science fiction concept used to further the pulpy adventure narrative. It is a classic example of pulp science fiction.
Okay, is Superman science fiction or fantasy?
That is another contested question.
I mean, I don't know. I have no idea.
The thing is, us, like, super science fiction fans don't know either, and we will argue amongst each other with great vitriol over these questions. I read the introduction to one Kevin J. Anderson Superman book saying, Superman is the ultimate science fiction concept. I don't remember his exact reasoning, but I do remember that being his argument. It was one of the Superman comic writers. I forget which one.
Okay, I'm going to give you another book. The only book I ever read that's science fiction. At least my husband says it's science fiction. I've been arguing with him that it's not. A, because I really enjoyed it, and B, because I really thought it wasn't science fiction, is Ready Player One. Have you read it?
I have not read the book. I have seen the Spielberg movie, and my impression with that, it's more pulp science fiction. It's the whole notion of this digitally created other world is another old science fiction trope that's been used for various purposes. And here, as with the genetic uplifting of animals in Guardians of the Galaxy, is a way of using a science fiction concept to further a pulp adventure narrative. That's an old thing.
So you're going to say that's more of a soft science fiction then?
Yes, yes. I would definitely say Ready Player One is soft science fiction.
Okay, so what would you recommend to someone like me who stays away from science fiction because I'm not into space and spacecrafts and all of that. So when you talk to me and you're like, hey, you should read science fiction, I'm like, no space, no spacecraft. Thank you very much. I don't need science fiction. What would you say to someone like me and get me into most likely soft science fiction, but what would you say and what would you recommend?
I mean, science fiction is such a diverse genre that it has to be tailored to anybody who wants to get into it because there are different things for different people. And there is a long history of science fiction being used as a form of social commentary and a long history of more worldly science fiction. Let's see, because a lot of what I read is like somewhat inaccessible to like the absolute neophyte. Like for someone who wants to go get into like modern science fiction, like of the past 20, 30 years, Ted Chiang's short story collections, Exhalation and Stories of Your Life and Others. Some of that is technically fantasy, but he is very rigorous about the implications of his magic in a way that befits a hard science fiction author. For like the early like proto science fiction, I would recommend H.G. Wells. I think he is a very interesting author, sometimes dated, but often shockingly ahead of his time. For mid-century science fiction, I'd recommend Arthur C. Clarke. He was one of the authors that got me into science fiction. I think my whole love affair with the genre opened when a friend of mine gave me a collection of Clarke's short stories. And it just spiraled from there. So I'm still trying to think of things that you would. One author who is very good at that sort of thing, and I wholeheartedly recommend to anyone looking to get into written science fiction after watching something like Guardians of the Galaxy or Ready Player One, Timothy Zahn.
Okay.
He is most famous for writing Star Wars books, and by Star Wars fans, he is credited as the guy who saved Star Wars in the early 90s with his Thrawn trilogy. And it is beloved by Star Wars fans, and having read it, I totally agree with him. He's a fantastic writer. He writes action very well. For those who don't want to get into the labyrinthine nature of Star Wars canon, I'd recommend the Icarus Hunt, which could easily be a blockbuster movie, I think.
Okay.
And after that, his Conqueror's trilogy, which is a bit more high concept, but I thought was fantastic, and I think is still pretty accessible to newcomers to the genre.
So here's my other question. If I was a science fiction expert, aficionado, whatever you want to call those people, like yourself, and you're talking to me, and what books in your mind would say, you have not read this and this. I'm sorry, you cannot be a sci-fi geek. I mean, I'm sorry. These are the, you know, the main books that all sci-fi people read. It's kind of like if you love fantasy and you haven't read Harry Potter, don't talk to me.
Oh, that's hard because many of the great science fiction classics I haven't read only because I've been reading lesser known science fiction things. But from stuff I've read in the past couple of years, Childhood's End by Arthur C. Clarke is fantastic mid-century science fiction. It was one of the books that really converted me into being a science fiction fan. For like the early, the early 20th century stuff, so for like even like late 19th century stuff, A Smattering of H.G. Wells and Jules Verne. I prefer Wells to Verne, but Verne has written some fantastic things too. Absolutely, The War of the Worlds. If I had to choose just one book from that era, this is the book that invented the alien invasion. And it has given so much to the genre. And once you read it, you start to see its footprints everywhere.
Okay. See, that's where the word alien, I'm out. Alien, stars, spaceship, all of that, I'm out. But okay, maybe I think I'd like to try those short stories you mentioned earlier and see if I can gently nudge my way in. Okay, let's switch tracks. Let's get out of science fiction. You're also an expert in alternative history.
Alternate history, yes.
Alternate history, okay.
Yeah, we don't like the word alternative because that makes people think we're crackpots, and we're not, we're just nerds. Alternate history, it's the art of asking what if in terms of history, what if one side won a war, won when it didn't otherwise, etc. Also, a lot of time travel stuff falls under alternate history depending on how rigorous and how thoroughly you explore the implications of the time travel. Alternate history, it's been my preferred subgenre of science fiction, if you can even call it that. That's something people get mad about. Since I started reading a Harry Turtelove's World War series in 2011 when I was 14, and there are 8 books, and I read all of them in the span of about a month, and I was enthralled. And he's a very common entryway into alternate history as a genre. And I still like him despite many alternate history nerds turning against him in the past 7 or 8 years.
So alternate history seems like when you say time travel, obviously I think alternate history then is very closely linked with sci-fi. Are there examples when you could have an alternate history that is not linked with sci-fi? Like that is not linked with time travel for someone to actually go back and change history, but just I'm just writing a alternate historic fiction.
Absolutely. That is what people would generally refer to as hard alternate history, and the purists would refer to as the only true alternate history. And they don't like alternate history where the supernatural is involved. I would argue against that on the basis that the kernels of the modern genre coalesced in alternate world stories in 30s pulp magazines. But in terms of like grounded alternate history, there are many examples. There's Harry Turtelove's Timeline 191 series, which is 11 books about a world in which during the American Civil War, General Lee doesn't lose his plans for the invasion of Maryland, which in our world were in a complete fluke found wrapped around a cigar by Union troops so they could counter it and prevent Lee's invasion of Maryland. And this is 11 books in a world where that doesn't happen and the Confederacy gets its independence. And it spans the history of these two countries in North America sparring with one another up until the mid-1940s.
Wow.
Yeah, Turtelove, he is famous for his very long stories that have gotten a lot of people in the history, myself included.
What happens, I guess technically, if someone wrote an alternate history, it has to be before 2020 then. It has to be events that took place before 2020 that ended, because you can't really predict 2025. And if you did predict 2025, then you're going into, what would that be called? If you're predicting a future, like, I think Orwell's 1984 was written way before 1984.
Yeah, in mid-40s.
Okay. So what is 1984? What genre is that? I know it's dystopian fiction, but there is a history element to it.
I mean, this is something that many science fiction nerds will die on. This is a hill we will contest, that 1984 is science fiction, because it involved a prediction of what might be of the future from the vantage point from which it was written in the mid-40s. It involves the use of technology as a force for social control, the telescreens, all the drugs they use, the controlling of historical narratives. And yeah, we believe it is a classic of science fiction, no matter what certain pompous literary critics will tell us otherwise.
So most, if not all, dystopian fictions are essentially science fiction then. So dystopia is saved for science fiction. Would you agree or disagree?
Not always. There are dystopias in which the dystopian method of control is explicitly magical. I would call that a fantasy dystopia. But in terms of what the dystopian genre sets out to do in its fundamental conceits, it leads to science fiction. It's a way of showing now, but worse. So oftentimes it is science fiction. And I would argue that pretty much all the great dystopian novels are science fiction. And frankly, some people just don't want to admit that.
And a lot of them are not just science fiction, but they're also alternate history, technically.
I wouldn't say so on the basis they were written describing the future from the vantage point from which they were written. We in the Alden history community call certain outdated science fiction to be honorary Alden history, but the nitty gritty of the whole thing is that it was a conscious attempt to change the future, whereas Alden history is a conscious attempt to change the past. The past from the vantage point of the writer.
Okay. So again, for someone like me who has not read alternate history, what are some basic books you would start me on? That won't turn me off. Something chill and fun, adventurous, that kind of thing.
So I got into it through reading Harry Turtledove's big series. I would not recommend them to somebody like you, because you need to have a certain, A, being a history nerd, and B, an appreciation for the broad scope of human events, like really appreciate them. For like smaller scale things, some of Turtledove's standalones are very good. Ruled Britannia, which is about a world where the Spanish Armada succeeds, and it follows the story of a rebellious playwright writing plays against the Spanish occupation force by the name of William Shakespeare.
Ah, I've heard of him.
Which is a really fun little one. Another good one to start, although I would call this one rather bleak. It's called Fatherland by Robert Harris. A world in which, during the invasion of the Soviet Union, the Nazis got the Baku oil fields, and you have this surviving Third Reich into the 1960s, and it is, in the novel, starting to show signs of decay. It's starting to come apart at the seams, because the whole enterprise of the Third Reich was an unstable one. I mean, World War II Alden histories are like a thing in their own. It's a thing that is almost a subgenre at this point. And Fatherland is a very good introduction to that that particular milieu. Another good one I think that's pretty accessible to the newcomer is The Impeachment of Abraham Lincoln by Stephen Carter. It's a world where Abraham Lincoln survives his assassination. And
oh, wow.
And so after that, the radical Republicans are trying him for violating the Constitution during the Civil War, like the suspension of habeas corpus. And the novel follows his legal counsel, its main character being a black woman who was hired as a clerk and gets caught up in all this political wrangling about impeaching or not impeaching Lincoln.
Oh, wow. Lincoln and impeachment in the same sentence. Blasphemy, I'll tell you that. I'm like, how dare they?
It's habeas corpus.
What's your favorite alternate history timeline?
That's a hard question, and I think you sort of inadvertently stumbled into a big distinction in the alternate community, is that we use timeline often to refer to an online work rather than a published print work. But that line has started to blur with the creation of the world's only alternate history publishing house, Sea Lion Press.
Really? Sea Lion's alternate history, huh? I did not know that. Okay.
That the name Sea Lion is an old in-joke in the community. It comes from Operation Sea Lion, which was, in World War II, the Nazis' unused plan to invade Britain. The reason this became an in-joke is that people kept asking, what if that succeeded? And then, like, the super nerd saying, for reasons X, Y, and Z, it never would have happened. It would have ended in miserable failure for the Germans. And so it's just become the alternate history community's most beloved in-joke. There was a time when on one of the big sites, the users were sending a plush sea lion to each other in the mail and like adding like a card. And it's in that jocular spirit that the name Sea Lion Press came about.
So how long has Sea Lion Press been publishing books?
2015, I think.
2015. Okay. So about 5 years.
Yes.
So here's my question. Do you have any connection with any of these presses, and do you get ARCs because of your link to blogs and the fact you've written a couple of articles? And if you do, what's upcoming?
I have not reviewed any books yet. I will do that at some point. I am not at the stage where I'm getting advanced review copies. I know at least one guy who does. So, like, if anyone wants to get into contact with him, I can furnish that. I have written several articles on like the theory of alternate history and a couple of honorary alternate history for the Sea Lion Press blog. Only one of those has been published as of recording, but in the next couple of weeks, those are going to be coming out. And I hope those go well. I'm a regular on the Sea Lion Press forum. I'm a member of their weekly Zoom calls. We just nerd out about the most tiny history nerd things imaginable. I think they know me. I don't think I am part of their high echelons.
Okay. All right. What is your experience with history? Do you believe people who read alternate history should read regular history and should be able to compare, and that's where the sauce is? Because let's say in some alternate world, I really didn't even know that Lincoln was assassinated. So I'm reading this book about this president, and his assassination attempt didn't go so well, and he wasn't assassinated, and I'm reading it, and I'm like going, oh, wow, this is pretty cool. And it wouldn't even be a thing to me unless I knew the actual history that, he was assassinated. So do you really believe that, at least I think people who read alternate history should be, like, on their regular history. They should know it in and out to really appreciate it.
They need to, at the very least, know the historical context to a degree of detail. You probably don't need to be an expert on it, but you should know something about it. There is a funny story that your Lincoln hypothetical reminds me of. There was a film adaptation of the novel Fatherland I recommended just a little bit ago.
Uh-huh.
And it was shown to test audiences. And the test audiences could not distinguish between the world of Fatherland, where the Nazis survived, and the actual existing East Germany.
Oh, wow.
Which I think proves your point pretty well.
What's your favorite genre to read? Or are you technically by reading sci-fi, I'm reading alternate history. By reading alternate history, I'm reading sci-fi. So technically, I'm just going to call it sci-fi alternate history genre.
Yeah, I read a lot of science fiction. I read a lot of alternate history. I am dipping my toes ever more quickly into fantasy. Just last night, I finished reading the second book in R.F. Kuang's Poppy War series, which is absolutely fantastic. Chinese-inspired fantasy, which I thought worked very well and delivered the gravitas of the situation portrayed in a very compelling way. So, yeah, that is a series I do recommend. The third and final book is coming about later this year, so hopefully I don't have to wait too long.
Cool. I mean, I would prefer to just wait, and then when everything's out, then read the book. Books, rather. That way I don't have to wait.
Yeah, I get that. I usually do that, but I saw enough people in internet nerd circles talking about the Poppy War, and it sounded like the sort of thing that I would find interesting and could get inspiration for the D&D game I'm running. Both the original and the sequel were available in my hometown's Overdrive system. And so I read them over a course of about 4 days, and I was deeply impressed.
Okay, very good. So you still use Overdrive, not Libby?
Yeah. The Overdrive system for my home county and for the other counties in the Washington, D.C. region are still active. And this is a thing that people in the D.C. area can do, is that there's a reciprocity agreement where if you live in one of the jurisdictions, you can get cards of the library systems of the other jurisdictions.
Okay.
So that means I have like 8 library cards and therefore 8 different library systems I can check for ebooks. So if one of them doesn't have it, I check the other 7.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, that's the advantage of living in a really big city. We have only, we have 3 different library systems here. So I have to get 3 different cards, and each card has several libraries within it. But I don't get like 1 card and access to every bit.
In the DC area, you still need the other card and the other number, but the reciprocity agreement allows you to get those other cards with other numbers and et cetera.
That's cool. I mean, I really wish they had an American library system where anyone in the country just gets 1 number, 1 card, access to any library using Libby or Overdrive. That would be nice.
Yes.
Go ahead.
I do know there are ways to get access to the New York Public Library's ebook collection if you don't live in the New York area. I am not super well informed as to how that works, but that might be something worth looking into.
Ah. I should, because there are books I look for. Now, whenever I look for a book in the library system, I haven't done this, but do you have experience with Overdrive where can you look up books based on genre, or do you just have to find a name and look for? Because right now, I just find a name and look for it. I haven't even tried to look for genre in Libby. I need to do that, maybe.
I know there are genre categorizations. I have not used them all that much, but I know they're there.
So when you read a book, how do you decide that you want to read a book?
It's a very fleeting process for me. It's a combination of what shows up as being available, what strikes my fancy, what is being talked about in internet nerd circles, what is being talked about in the broader public conscience, and sometimes I'll read nonfiction to like educate myself on that topic, whatever is making people talk about what makes people angry sometimes, and just having a sense of like what is considered to be good among certain online communities. Like for like nonfiction history, the subreddits History and Ask Historians both have very long book lists, and I've read several from those, and I can see their quality.
So I'm gonna ask you a question that I ask all my listeners. I mean, not all my listeners, rather everyone I talk to. Top five favorite books of all time.
That's a hard question.
You could pick a series as a book. You don't have to, like, you could just say Harry Potter as a book if you had to, you know, so I'll make that easier.
Oh, that's still hard. There's one of my favorite of all time is Harry Turtledove's World War series, and that includes the books that aren't billed as World War but are sequels to the original tetralogy, making a total of 8 books. And it is considered one of the great classics of the alternate history genre about an alien invasion during World War II. And it's like, that was like shockingly new to me when I was 14, and I devoured them. And it turned me into an alternate history fan. Another one would be Arthur C. Clarke's Childhood's End, which I mentioned before was another formative book for me as a science fiction reader. Another more recent series that is held in great regard by the science fiction community is the Remembrance of Earth's Past trilogy by Cixin Liu.
Okay.
Which was sort of the series that showed to the West that Chinese science fiction is a thing and is a thing we need to be paying attention to because it's producing some fantastic stuff. Cixin Liu is easily the standard bearer for Chinese science fiction's entrance into the Western mainstream. This is the series that starts with the probably more famous title, The Three-Body Problem, and has its 2 sequels and a prequel, kinda, but not really. And the fan fiction that got published with Cixin Liu's blessing by a different author, which is also good, but weird.
Okay.
That's 3. Another one that I credit with becoming a big science fiction author, the big science fiction reader, is the Binti trilogy by Nnedi Okorafor.
Okay.
Which was assigned, the first book was assigned to me for a college class, and I read it and I loved it, and it turns out I accidentally had gotten the whole trilogy, so I read those 2, and I was the only guy in the group discussion that had actually read the other books, and they thought I was weird, but I loved it, so I didn't care.
Well, I mean, there's nothing weird about reading, so.
Number 5. Oh, that part of me wants to say The War of the Worlds. Part of me wants to say some nonfiction history because I've read plenty of nonfiction history and I've read many, many fantastic books that deserve to be read from that way of writing. So if I had to choose one history book to give to the world, it is Robert Hughes's The Fatal Shore, which is about the early colonization of Australia, which is the single best history book I've ever read.
Okay. That's very, very good. Katie told me you knew someone from the Hugo Awards.
Knowing them, no. I'm currently reading through this year's slate for a science fiction association I'm part of. Yeah, I'm a member of the Washington Science Fiction Association, which just is a show of how much of a nerd I am.
Right. That's no worries.
So in most of the year, and we meet every 2 weeks, we discuss a magazine because science fiction for so long has lived and died on its short stories. But in the summer, we read the Hugo nominations because that gets decided in the summer. And I'm working my way. I've read all the short fiction and I've read 3 of the novels, and I need to read the 3 other novels within the next week or so. And I'll do that.
And these are the nominations for the Hugo Awards.
Yes.
But you're not actually part of the Hugo Awards, and you don't know the board that's responsible for picking the Hugo Awards.
So the Hugos are chosen through a ballot of members of a certain association. In retrospect, that's what I think Katie was referring to. Some of the older folks in the Washington Science Society are paying members and have the ballots to vote for their preferred nominees. I'm not one of those people. I'm not a member of that, but I am reading them so I can discuss them with the association and with people on the internet.
Okay. Yeah, that's cool. That's cool. I didn't know.
If you want, I can go on about my impressions of the nominees that I've read so far.
Go for it.
So the short fiction, I think, was overall pretty good. It was the novellas that were overall the strongest. The one I liked the most from the novellas was P. Jelly Clark's The Haunting of Tramcar 015. It is an urban fantasy set in a magical 1920s Cairo, in which some sort of spirit is haunting a overhead tramcar. Which sounds bizarre, and frankly, you're right, but I liked it. Other good ones from that slate are To Be Taught If Fortunate by Becky Chambers, which was my first experience with her, and like I totally see why so many people are raving about her. Very good novella about space exploration and the whole morality of that. I liked Ted Chiang's novella, which appeared in his collection Exhalation. Anxiety is the Dizziness of Freedom, which is weird in that way that Ted Chiang is weird, but is really, really fantastic. And I am not sure who I'm rooting for in the novellas. I think it's going to be Jelly Clark, but then it's the hard one between him, Chambers, and Chiang. I think Ted Chiang's Omphalos, which was also in Exhalation, was easily the best of all the novellas. It is one of a couple of Chiang stories where he does this thing where he takes some old conception of how the world works, assumes it's true for the purposes of the story, and then just rigorously interrogates the implications of that older notion of the world being true. Like for Omphalos, it's like a pre-Galilean cosmology where there's a finite number of stars that we've all cataloged, the sun revolves around the earth, that sort of thing. And he really interrogates what that would mean for people living in a world like that. And I thought it was fantastic. For the short stories, there was the one by Shiv Ramdas. And now the governor is laughing, and now the somebody is laughing, and it's somebody's title. And it's set in India during World War II in the wake of the Bengal famine, and a woman has developed a way of making automata. And then the British start being curious, and the story goes from there. That was my favorite short story.
Oh, wow. So that's very, very cool. See, now you've just opened up into you know, short story, and now you just talked about India, and then there was the Chinese versions, you know, the Chinese sci-fis that you discussed before. It's you think the genre can just expand and be more diverse also, potentially down the road.
Oh, absolutely. There's been a big push for diversity in the genre in the past 10, 15 years. There's been a lot of reckoning with some of the unpleasant parts of the genre's history. In a very real attempt to bring minority authors into higher prominence, Nnedi Okorafor is a Nigerian-American author who, as I said, I really do like. There's Ted Chen, who is Chinese-American. There's P.J. Lee Clark, who is African-American. One of the other ones who is talked a lot about a lot, but I haven't read much of hers, is N.K. Jemisin. I've read one of her novelettes. She has novelettes. And I thought it was okay. Wasn't a huge fan of that one, but I still need to read that big trilogy that won the three Hugos in 3 years in a row, which I've heard rave reviews, so I need to get my hand on a copy of those. There's another one, like Saladin Ahmed, who is Arab-American, who wrote a fantastic fantasy novel called Throne of the Crescent Moon, which is like Arabian Nights-style fantasy.
Ooh.
I really like that one. There's also a set, R.F. Kuang, with the Poppy War, very Chinese-influenced fantasy. There are others who are not coming to me at the moment, but it's very much a thing that the community is trying to emphasize, a vision of the future that aren't explicitly Western. It's something we're working on.
Yeah, I totally look forward to that. That would be so cool.
There is plenty now, and there is a lot more on the way, I'm certain.
I'm really glad you came on my podcast and educated me on all of this, because now I have some kind of a path to be like, okay, let me try this book and we'll see how it goes. So thank you so much for being on my podcast, and you know, thank you for educating me.
Thank you for having me.
That's it for this episode. Before I do, housekeeping notes that I will also add to the show notes, I just wanted to add something real quick. I cannot tell you how grateful I am for all of you. From the bottom of my heart, thank you for listening. And thank you to everyone who reached out to me after the Bookstagram cancel culture episode. It means a lot to me. So thank you, thank you, thank you. If you want to message Alex, just send me an email at livingalifethroughbooks@gmail.com and I'll be happy to send it on to him. Of course, you can email me to contact me about this or any other episode. You can also reach me through Instagram or Facebook at livingalifethroughbooks. I joined a new app called Swell. It's a great way to continue this conversation with me. I will add the link to Swell in my show notes so you can follow me there and see what's upcoming on this podcast and get more podcast news. My tag on Swell is at Bookish Podcast. I couldn't do Living a Life Through Books as it was too long a username. As I mentioned, the link will be in the show notes. Please share this podcast with your family and friends and on your social media pages. I would greatly appreciate it, and I thank you. If you loved this episode or any of my previous episodes, please consider writing me a review on Apple Podcasts or go to ratethispodcast.com/livingalifethroughbooks, and you can write me a review there. My website is shahnazahmed.com. That is shahnazahmed.com. I haven't been on it in a while. I need to make it look prettier, and that whole process seems to be the ongoing joke. But I'm hopeful. The opening and closing music to this and all my previous episodes was composed by my husband, Brad Slavik. I'm Dr. Shahnaz Ahmed, with Living a Life Through Books, signing off. Remember to water the seeds within you. It's time.